Joyful. Friendly competition inside the Civic Media Network of our hosts. As we know, I'm a very competitive person. You know how competitive I am? Prick me to start giving blood. They tell me that there has been a contest to see who can give, who can fill up their bag the fastest. 5 minutes, 4 seconds. I got done and I said, did I win? And I said, you were the fastest all day.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time. This is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin. Welcome to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Madnair. Thank you for joining us today during your lunch hour, the noon hour. At 12:30, we are going to be joined by Phil Rocco, Marquette Associate Professor of Political Science, who... before, back in the election cycle, wrote a piece on what a flat tax could look like in Wisconsin and why there's very few people that would benefit from that. But he's going to talk to us today about the plan that has actually been proposed by the Wisconsin legislature and what that could actually look like. So stick around for that conversation. But coming up first, we are joined by Bob Keefe, who is the executive director of E2 Environmental Entrepreneurs, which is a national nonpartisan group of business owners, investors, and professionals who leverage economic research and their business perspective to advance policies that are good for the environment and good for the economy. And at the break, we were talking about K-cups, and you said someone texted in about the K-cups? Because we're all skeptical now.
Yeah, and so there was a study done by Canadian researchers who found that using the individual K-cups is actually better for the environment than making the whole pot of coffee.
Yes.
So Texter from the 414 says, if I understand how this was determined, a K-cup is a definite amount in a specific usage, whereas making a pot is using a whole bunch of coffee, whether it all gets consumed or not. The savings to the earth come from using less coffee beans, less farming, etc. This is how I understand it. So thank you from the 414.
Bob, what do you think? Do you buy that?
You know, I have a hard time buying that. I mean, yes, we are taxing our environment with coffee farms and with water and all of that. But gosh, just throwing those little cups in the garbage or even recycling them and knowing that they're probably not being recycled just seems like a bad deal.
I
don't buy it.
I agree.
I'm sticking with the Mr. Coffee myself.
There
I'm sticking with the coffee pot.
There you go. All right. Well, Bob Keefe, thank you so much for joining the show today. And so tell us more before we're going to talk more about clean jobs in Wisconsin and the economic impact that being how you can both be good for the economy and for the environment. But tell us more just about environmental entrepreneurs.
Absolutely. And listen, I'm so excited to be with you guys. What a cool idea for a show, taking things like flat taxes and climate change and making them fun and interesting. I was hoping you were going to start with a couple of climate jokes or something, Kristen. No? You got any good climate jokes?
Do I have any good climate jokes? No.
I've been thinking all weekend about this. I'm waiting for the opening. I've been thinking of all weekend about something to use on your show that would be befitting of such a wise and cool and interesting show in such an interesting state. Just for the record,
can I try it? Go ahead.
So we all know about and what's a better joke than a fart joke, right? We all know about cows. We all know about methane and how that's adding to global warming, right?
Yeah.
So why did the Wisconsin dairy farmer worry so much about global warming?
Why,
Kristen? Because his cows kept cutting the cheese. Come on, huh?
All right. Did you come up with that?
I did.
Nice.
As far as you know.
Golf clap.
It was either me or one of my daughters.
That was pretty clever. Cutting the cheese. Smell our dairy air.
That's. But all joking aside, climate change is a serious issue, right?
Yeah.
You asked me about my organization, E2 Environmental Entrepreneurs. We're a national network of more than 10,000 people, 10,000 business owners, investors, and others who care about the economy and care about the environment. And we do a lot of work around making the economic case and telling the economic story about how the economy and the environment are not at odds, but we can't have one without the other. And what we're seeing now in this country, in this world, in your state, is that the economic costs of climate change are adding up. Climate change is battering our economy, from farmers to the outdoor industry to business people to everyday homeowners. Good news is we can do something about it. We're finally doing something about it, and we're creating a lot of jobs, driving economic growth by doing so and reducing those costs that we're all feeling.
So, because I think to a certain extent, we understand when you talk about clean energy jobs, it's jobs that work in windmills or solar power or something. So, like, what kind of, like, how broad, or what are we actually talking about when we talk about clean energy jobs?
Right, right. Well, naturally, you're going to think about the wind turbine worker or
totally.
The guy or woman installing solar panels on your roof, right? But the clean energy space is a lot bigger than that. And my organization, E2, has been tracking clean energy jobs around the country for more than a decade now. And what we now know, Kristen, is that there are more than 3 million people, about 3.2 million people that work in clean energy in every single state in the country. And then in Wisconsin alone, we're talking about 71,000 Wisconsinites, according to our latest Clean Jobs America report and a companion report that we do called Clean Jobs Midwest that breaks all this stuff down for every state and every sector. So when you look at those 71,000 jobs in Wisconsin, about 6,500 of them are in renewable energy. Yes, the solar and the wind folks like you're talking about. Another 6,000 work in clean vehicles, supply chains for the car companies that are making electric vehicles, or we track any job that is related to a car that has a plug in it. So hybrid plug-in vehicles, for instance, those sort of things. But the biggest part of the clean energy space is something we don't really think about too much, which is energy efficiency. About 58,000 people work in energy efficiency-related jobs in Wisconsin. What does that look like? Those are construction workers putting insulation in our roofs or changing out our windows in our houses, in our offices, in our homes. It's electricians working on LED lighting systems in our big office buildings in our cities and in our towns that are saving consumers and businesses money with every monthly electric bill. A lot of it is around the HVAC work, heating, air conditioning, ventilation work. Companies that are swapping out dirty old gas or other furnaces with electric and more energy efficiency models, things like that. And by the way, it's also all of the people that are working in factories, I think including some in Wisconsin, that are making Energy Star appliances, whether it's better dishwashers and refrigerators that are going in our homes, or huge energy efficient heating and air conditioning systems that are going into office buildings around the country. So the good news is these jobs are spread across a lot of occupations. They typically pay a little bit better than jobs that similar jobs in non-clean energy businesses. And with some of the policies that we recently passed in Washington and elsewhere, there's going to be a lot more of them.
So it sounds like, I mean, at least as you just described it, it's a pretty broad definition of what can fall under, because I would not have thought that just working on the appliances that are high efficiency appliances is then categorized under clean energy jobs. And so did you know that, Jane? And so that's like, that's really encouraging, because I think you're right. I think my mind goes to people working on installing solar panels, or people working on the wind and EV, yes, for sure. But even the manufacturing of products that are just energy efficient is really interesting, because I wouldn't have thought that, especially in a manufacturing state like Wisconsin historically. I think more people should know that that also falls under what the clean energy sector can do for jobs.
Absolutely. And just for the record, our data is based on data and the way that the Department of Energy tracks it, the U.S. Department of Energy. So that's how they track energy jobs, period. So they also track jobs in oil and gas and jobs in coal, jobs in nuclear, et cetera. And this is how the Department of Energy tracks clean energy jobs now. And if you look across it, all those sectors in energy, there are about 2.5 times as many people that work in clean energy now than work in fossil fuel energy, believe it or not.
Wow.
And that matters in a place like Wisconsin, which, by the way, doesn't have a lot of coal or gas the last time I was there, but it does have some cold winters. And it does have some energy efficiency people, right?
I know that twang makes me think that you're from the South, and so you're not less likely to have experienced as many cold winters as we have.
I've done my best to avoid winters my entire life, so yes.
We're talking to Bob Keefe, who's the executive director of E2 Environmental Entrepreneurs. Jane, do you have a question?
I do. Bob, I just want to say you give me hope that more businesses are embracing this, because it's always seemed completely counterproductive to me that you're going to destroy the environment and you're going to kill off your customers. This does not seem like a good business model.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And look, the other thing is, from a business perspective, this is a bottom line issue as well, right? Some of the biggest drivers of clean energy growth in this country have been really big technology companies. And why is that? Because they use really big data centers to make things like this internet chat happen and to make our email happen and everything we do online. Those data centers use a ton of electricity, and they want the cheapest electricity there is. And right now, the cheapest electricity there is, hands down, in just about every single part of the country, just about every single part of the world, is solar and wind. So a lot of the solar and the wind growth that we've seen over the years has been because businesses and major employers and major users of electricity are looking for a cheaper route. The good news is we're here.
Absolutely. It's here. So when we come back, because I want to bring you through the break, because I want to talk more specifically about Wisconsin and, you know, what creates, because it sounds like we're, top 20 for how many clean energy jobs we have here?
Yeah.
Which is great. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And so talking about maybe how we got to where we are right now, what can encourage more job growth politically, how this is faring. So when we come back from our from this break, Bob Keefe, executive director of E2 Environmental Entrepreneurs, will still be here. Maybe he'll even have another funny joke for us about cows cutting the cheese in the derriere of Wisconsin. All right, this is As Goes Wisconsin.
You are listening to As Goes Wisconsin, a product of Civic Media. Enjoy it live across Wisconsin, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. Find your local station on our website, civicmedia.us, or on the Civic Media app, and catch any of your favorite shows as a podcast wherever you listen.
Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. I got Jane Matinere on the board, and we are talking to Bob Keefe, who is the executive director of E2 Environmental Entrepreneurs. And I was kind of surprised, I was going to say, when I found out that Wisconsin ranks number 17 out of all 50 states in clean energy jobs. And so what, as far as, I know you were talking about the Midwest jobs report, but what is it in Wisconsin? Is it what you were saying before as far as those high efficiency appliances?
Well, there has been a lot of growth in energy efficiency in Wisconsin, and that's jobs at manufacturing plants making Energy Star appliances for sure. Another huge area that saw a real jump last year in Wisconsin and nationally, Kristen, and will continue to, is around electric vehicles. Look, every single car maker in the country, every single car maker in the world is shifting to electric vehicles right now. And last year alone in Wisconsin, there was a 26% increase in the number of people that are working in electric vehicle related jobs. These are, again, electric vehicles, hybrid plug-ins, et cetera. More than 6,000 people now work in Wisconsin in that area. So it's going to be huge. And when we think of some of the federal policies that have recently passed, the two biggest is the Inflation Reduction Act and the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the big bipartisan infrastructure mm-hmm. act. Those are going to create tremendous tax benefits and investments into clean energy, including into electric vehicles, but also into wind, into solar, into energy efficiency. So that is going to be, we think, is one of the biggest job drivers this country has ever seen. Sounds like hyperbole, but it's not.
It's not.
Or hyperbole. It sounds like hyperbole, too,
hyperbole.
By the way.
I just love your accent. So, you know, we talked about a little bit about this on Friday, because Wisconsin right now, as you referenced before, we do have very cold winters comparatively, but comparatively internally, our winters are only getting warmer and warmer. In fact, in Milwaukee and Green Bay, more than any other city in the country is seeing the biggest overall average increase in temperature each winter, which is a problem. Like, we're seeing the problems in our Great Lakes not having enough ice and what that does to a lot of different things. And so in that conversation, we saw that $165 billion it's cost to clean up the 18 major climate catastrophes that happened in 2022. And so as the core part of E2 being what's both good for the environment and good for the economy, like, what, how does this come down to, like, your mission statement of convincing people that the both can exist together?
Right, right. Well, look at those numbers a little bit more, Chris. And I mean, nationally, yes, it was $165 billion worth of damage last year alone. In Wisconsin alone, it was more than $2 billion. And if you look over time, most of that has been from flooding, from some of the things that you were just talking about, when you have a faster snow melt, when you have extreme rainfall, which the state has experienced in spades in recent years. You know, of the $17 billion in climate-related disasters in Wisconsin since 1980, about half of that, more than half of that, $8 billion has been from flooding alone. That's according to NOAA, some of those numbers that you were talking about. And so what does that look like? What does that mean to our economy? Well, it means that farmers' fields are getting flooded out. When farmers' fields get flooded out, that obviously impacts one of the biggest sectors of the state's economy, but it also impacts us all at the grocery line, right? It causes the price of food and other goods to go up. Look at what happens when snowpack is not what it used to be. That's a big hit on Wisconsin's outdoor industry, for instance, which is a $9 billion industry. 90,000 people work in outdoor-related jobs in your state. That's skiing and fishing and everything else that's getting battered by climate change.
And so how long have you been working? Because you also wrote a book. You're the author of Say it for me.
You're not the first one. Climate-nomics.
Climate-nomics. Thank you. Washington, Wall Street, and the Economic Battle to Save Our Planet. And so how, since you've started working in this industry, I guess, of evangelizing that these two can coexist, how much have you seen attitudes change, specifically on Wall Street and of business owners?
Well, it's getting to be an easier story to tell and an easier story to understand. Look, I mean, yes, climate change has been happening since the beginning of history, but the past 8 years have been the 8 warmest years on record globally. In the past decade, we've had 7 of the most expensive years for climate disasters. So this is hitting people in the pocketbook, right? I mean, look at homeowners insurance. Homeowners insurance is up 50% over the past decade. Anybody who owns a home is paying more because those insurance companies are getting hammered by hurricanes in the east and fires in the west, et cetera. So to me, the discussion is changing. People are starting to understand that this is a pocketbook issue. And when something becomes a pocketbook issue, it becomes more relevant to people and they care more about it. And what I like to say, Kristen, during the break, we were talking a little bit about the politics of all of this. What I like to say is, look, I don't care if you believe in science. I don't care if you like polar bears. I don't care if you drive a Prius or a pickup truck. The fact of the matter is climate change is hitting you in the pocketbook.
Yeah.
And we've got to do something about it. And again, the good news is, thanks to some of these policies that we passed at the federal level. Some of the stuff that we hope the state is moving forward in Wisconsin will be able to not only reduce some of these costs of climate change, but drive jobs and economic growth while doing it.
Absolutely. Well, for any of our listeners who want more information, where can they get more information either about you, your book, or E2?
Well, thank you for that. Absolutely. Go to e2.org to find out more about E2, and you can look up some of this data on the state and both jobs and costs, and also nationally. If you want to know about the book, go to climatenomicsbook.com, climatenomicsbook.com.
Awesome. Well, Bob Keefe, thank you so much for spending time with us today. Thank you for the joke, and we'll have to have you back when the next jobs report comes out.
I'd like that. Thank you, Kristen.
All right. Have a great day. Coming up next, Phil Rocco from Marquette University will be here to talk about the implications of a flat tax. Stay with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
One, two, three, four. One, two.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me.
Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. Jane Matinair is on the board. No matter where you're listening across the Civic Media Network or on the Civic Media app, thank you for tuning in. And a reminder that if you miss any part of today's show, you can always listen to it as a podcast, which you can find on asgoeswisconsin.com/listen or wherever you find podcasts. And today, I know you're right on this, Jane, but today is the first day that you can start turning in your taxes. They're starting to accept your if you want to get your tax refund. I don't know if I'll get a tax refund or not this year.
Really?
But we'll find out. But with that, we thought we maybe would talk a little bit more about what future taxes could potentially look like in the great state of Wisconsin. So Dr. Phil Rocco is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University, and this is his, I think, third time joining us on the show.
Three-peat? Is that a hat trick?
Three-peat. I like that. Yeah. So friend of the show, officially, I would say. And
all right.
I invited you on because back in election season, when the flat tax was just an idea that Tim Michaels kind of threw out there, and then the conservatives were very upset that people took him at his word. Well, it's not actually a plan. And now we actually do have a plan. But in the hypothetical stages, you wrote a guest article for Recombobulation Area about what a flat tax would do for most of us in Wisconsin. And it was great. It was very detailed. And now we actually have a plan that has been proposed that would take, I think, is it 3.25? A flat tax of 3.25%?
Right.
So
yeah, it would be a flat tax of 3.25%.
Which is pretty low.
Yes.
Which is pretty low.
Like for comparison, like right now, the tax rates go from 3.45, I think, all the way up to 7.56% for the top bracket. So that's a lot of revenue disappearing overnight. And the thing that was interesting was that when we wrote that piece back in the fall, like there were two different versions of the flat tax that were sort of floating out there. One of them was a flat tax with a slightly higher rate, mm-hmm. which meant that, some people's taxes would in fact go up. Lower income folks' taxes would go up, but you wouldn't have, as much revenue disappearing. The other option was this kind of flat tax, which just brings down the top rates to the lowest, or in this case, below the lowest rate. And what it means in practical terms is two things. One is that it can only be described as sort of like a bonanza for people at the top part of the income distribution. So the richest 1.4% of taxpayers under this proposal get 1/3 of the total kind of benefits, right? In monetary terms.
And how many people does that end up being? Is that just like,
I mean, one.
So it's 1% of our population?
Right. That's, it's a pretty small number. So, I mean, I think, just a pretty small number of taxpayers.
And do we know what threshold of how much those people are making?
So that's the 1.4%. That's people making 500,000 and over.
Okay.
Right. So they're going to see that 1.4% is going to see about a one third of the tax breaks. The 70% of the taxpayers are going to receive only about 17.8% of the total tax cut. So, I mean, you know, in practical terms, this is not going to be, there's going to be like a few movies and maybe dinner, you know, per year for most filers. But for the people at the top of the income distribution, it's like a windfall. It's a lot. So that's the first thing, just in terms of like, you know, the rates, you know, are going to seem like they come down, right? But in reality, most of the benefit is concentrated at the very top of the income distribution. The only thing, the only other thing, and we can talk about this more maybe, you know, after the break, is that it's not just who the tax cuts are going to. It's also the fact that every year when this is fully implemented, over $5 billion in revenue is just going to disappear. And if you put that in practical terms, it means that you could cut something like, you know, the entire UW system budget and all funding for corrections, and you would still need to cut more in order to account for that. And you can do all kinds of comparisons, like it's more than four times all state K-12 spending, you know, more than four times like the state and local state shared revenue to local governments. Like, it's a lot of money.
And, I mean, it's also basically almost as much as our surplus is right now.
Yeah. I mean, so this idea is like the surplus is going to maybe like hide the effects of this for like a year. But then once it's fully implemented, it's a lot of revenue going out the door very, very quickly in a way that would be very dramatically, would result in some dramatic negative economic effects for the state, which we can talk about. But the idea that LeMahieu and Republicans are kind of pushing here is that like the surplus means that we're overtaxed, but the surplus is really sort of like a one-time perfect storm because of a variety of different trends. It's not like part of a bigger trend. So what that means is that once that surplus is gone, this is going to be a dramatic reduction in, or require dramatic reduction in state spending. Or alternatively, they could just raise, you know, the sales tax, but they'd have to raise it a lot in order to make up the difference, which is, you know, a regressive tax, a tax that's going to fall mostly on working class, middle class folks. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways to like project the future and like how this could work out. But the bottom line is distributionally for most people, this is going to mean not a lot of savings in terms of taxes and potentially huge cuts to vital services that people have come to rely on.
Phil, just a couple things. First of all, I can't be the only person who just lies awake at night, tossing and turning, worried that the wealthiest 1.4% in Wisconsin are struggling to buy a third vacation home. It's so painful, and I've lost so much sleep. But additionally, a couple of years ago, didn't they try this, something like this, in Kansas? And they essentially broke Kansas?
Yes, this is what was called the Kansas experiment, right? What governor Sam Brownback at the time described as an adrenaline shot in the heart of the Kansas economy. And it was the largest tax cut they'd ever seen in Kansas. It brought down the top rate from like 6.4% down to 4.9%. So that the wealthiest people were paying basically the same marginal rate as the middle class. And the idea was that plus a bunch of different other things, we're going to generate all of this new investment in Kansas. Employers were going to start setting up shop there. You're going to see this huge kind of multiplier effect. In fact, the reverse happened, right? So what that meant was that the state had to slash spending in fairly exorbitant ways, right? Cutting money for highways, cutting money for the state Medicaid program, cutting money for schools, like so that janitors and librarians couldn't get hired. And what that did was it reduced all of the sort of like economic multiplier effect that government spending has. So like when government spends, it means that people have contracts, private contractors who do business with the government get hired. There are all of these sort of attendant knock-on effects of government spending. And as a result, when you simply cut, you know, and, you know, Kansas cut a great deal, it basically meant that it couldn't fund a lot of these programs, and actually made it much sort of less attractive to come into the state because the state just wasn't offering a lot of services. So population growth kind of flattened out. And then by any sort of like any economic indicator, job growth, economic development or investment, the state just started tanking. And so by August 2014, S&P downgraded the state's credit rating. Like, it was an economic disaster of unmitigated proportions that ultimately like led to Sam Brownback, who was once, I think, seen as a kind of potential presidential contender. It was a disgrace for him, and he sort of like left public life.
Oh my gosh.
Right. And so it's really hard to overstate just like what a just political and economic disaster was. And then guess what? They ended up repealing it because it was such a disaster.
So we're talking to Dr. Phil Rocco, who is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University, about the proposed flat tax in Wisconsin. And has anyone ran that Kansas story by LaMahieu and Voss and been like, hey, how would we make it not, how would we avoid being like Kansas?
Well, there's like, there's this like alternative, like this like a speculative fiction universe of like what people say the whole Kansas experiment was really about. Like, so there's a whole like literature, like literature that like comes from conservative think tanks. It's like, no, it actually wasn't, you know, the tax cuts that caused all of these things. And they point to like any number of like a concatenation of other factors. Like, well, it must have been something else, right? But when you look at Kansas, and you can just do the comparison to all of its neighboring states, that all of the different things that people suggest were going on in Kansas, they were also going on in those neighboring states. And what happened was like none of those neighboring states faced essentially the economic cliff that Kansas did. And so it's really hard to conclude that it's not the, you know, this yeah. Kansas experiment. But the thing is, it's really inconvenient for them to talk about this. I mean, it's because it's a really great example of just what it means to get rid of. So like the argument that I think is being made is that like a lot of this spending that's going on is like wasteful, right? And that like, it's not a big deal to cut over $5 billion a year because there's so much waste. But the reality is like waste, or, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse, like, is a really, really small percentage, right? If you were able to like calculate it, it's like really small percentage of what government actually does. And most of what government does is actually help to stimulate economic growth in the, you know, a variety of regions in the state. And so when you just, I think people can't actually conceptualize what that scale of cuts means for their everyday life, for the highways, right? You think about like the worst highway you've ever driven on in Wisconsin, and imagine it getting perpetually worse. Like, that's what $5 billion a year in outflow of revenue, you know, will make happen. Alternatively, you know, it's like a sale, potentially like that spending cuts plus a prohibitively high sales tax for a lot of people. So the argument I think that is getting made is that like, that somehow this is going to induce population growth in the state, and that it's actually like the progressivity of the tax code that's inhibiting that. The thing I would point to is that the projected population growth for Minnesota, more progressive tax code, is 12% out to 2040. Wisconsin's is already only 3% projected population growth out to 2040. There's no way on earth that, you know, what's going on here, or what might be going on here, is a, you know, a population surge as a result of a flat tax. There's, you know, it just, it defies the most basic common sense to make that argument.
And we can keep talking about it after the break, because we only have about 2 minutes left before we have to go to the commercial. But it's also because I hear this a lot, and you think of like the states that are growing fastest, a lot of them do have like sometimes no income tax, Texas, Florida. But they're also, I always say this, they're also a lot warmer than us. But I think that's so interesting to compare it to Minnesota, who's arguably colder than us, and And he had to be like a Vikings fan. But you know, and the fact that I didn't know that discrepancy as far as what their population trend has been, despite it being a much more, it's in the last 12, 13 years, like the discrepancy between policies and how much they've been different, with all things being the same as far as weather, climate, culture. And so we'll talk more about that when we get back.
But yeah, also, absolutely.
Yeah. And there's so many different ways I wanted to go with this, and we'll only have you for 8 minutes. So we'll just have to have you back, but stay with us. Dr. Phil Rocco is here. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. We are talking to Dr. Phil Rocco, who is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University, about the potential implications of a Wisconsin flat tax, which the current proposal sits at 3.25%, and what that could mean for Wisconsin. And this isn't, even before the flat tax, since I've moved home or moved back, there's been conversations around no income tax and what that could do. Mm-hmm. And there are some states, what is there, like 9 in total that have no income tax? But I think of, you know, Tennessee, Florida, Texas, I think Alaska, maybe Wyoming. But some of the states that can generate enough revenue otherwise to function without having an income tax. So what it kind of has to be in place, as far as you understand it, for a low to no income tax to work in a state?
Yeah. So like some states have deposits of natural resources that they can have franchise taxes on, right? I think about Alaska, you know, out west, there are states that just have a naturally occurring resource that you can sort of tax and generate revenue off of that. Okay. Other states have booming industries that bring in people who don't live in the state as tourists frequently. And you can use sales taxes much more effectively there because, you know, you have such a kind of booming tourist industry in dollar terms, right? So what ultimately you have to do if you don't want to have an income tax is like one option is you have to have some other sort of resource there. It's like a special tax that you can just leverage. The other thing you could do is create a really regressive tax code, right? That where you're relying on taxes that mainly fall on people who are poor, or you know, working class, middle class folks, rely more heavily on property tax, which is something that states, you know, used to do. Wisconsin was one of the big pioneers in the early 20th century, 1911, in really moving the state to a progressive income tax because property is so hard to effectively and efficiently tax without, you know, a measure of corruption kind of getting involved there. So that was the big complaint about in the 19th century. It's really easy to hide property value and property wealth, especially back then. The other thing that you can do is just like slash services and just like, you know, make government a lot less effective at doing the things we expected to do. And that's something that you definitely see in states that don't have kind of effective income tax regimes. But I think the thing that ultimately, you know, is sort of happening in Wisconsin is, you know, essentially every time the state cuts taxes, and by the way, we are already at the lowest mm-hmm. level of tax collection, lowest rate of tax collection on record, right? That's how much taxes have come down since the 1990s. Like it is, we have really sucked out a lot of revenue in the state. And what that means, it's not like the demand goes away. It just means that either we're saying, you know, that we're not going to meet that demand, or we're pushing off the responsibility onto other levels of government, like local governments, or which is why you see so many bond measures millage increases in school districts now, right? Because there's still demand. We still have to pay for things.
Yeah.
Unless you just want, you know, the basic services that we expect as a society just fall apart. And it's also, I think, why governments are in such a, local governments are in such a difficult position right now, an increasingly impossible one. And so, like, that's the sort of bigger picture here. It's like, you know, it's easy to say, or easy to sort of have this concept, like, we're going to, you know, decrease taxes, step two, question mark, step two, step three, profit, right? The South Park underwear gnomes. But I think the bigger thing is that, like, the population trends in Wisconsin are really emblematic of population trends across the country. Like, people are moving from colder to warmer climates. Mm-hmm. That is not about taxes.
Yep.
Right. But then you look at Minnesota and it's like, why are people moving to that cold state, which in many cases is like colder than here, yeah, even, and less so to Wisconsin. And I think one of the really important answers is that you have economic policies that have led to the growth of a thriving, you know, metropolitan region in the Twin Cities, whereas Wisconsin is really disinvested from the economic power, you know, potential economic powerhouses of the state. And I think about the UW system as like one big place that when you cut the UW system, you are cutting an engine of economic growth for the state. That's what you're doing. You can say that you are, you know, sticking it to, you know, quote unquote, like liberal professors and elites and so forth. But what you're doing is you're screwing over the economy of the state.
Yeah. So, I mean, what this all obviously comes down to what will be months from now, the final budget. But it feels like this would be a non-starter as far as something that Governor Evers would sign. But do you think that there's any room for any kind of flat tax, even if it was a little bit higher? Or do you think this is dead in the water?
No, I think this is based. It would be hard to say that this is not, you know, dead in the water. The question is, you know, how much, how much do Republicans want to like press the issue and extend budget negotiations and go to the mats over this, right? Yeah. How long do they want the budget fight effectively to be? And I think, you know, one thing that is going to be interesting is how the narrative about the flat tax kind of spins out there. I think the thing that Republicans, the sort of advantage this sort of accrues to them in debates like this is that, like, not much information gets out there about what the flat tax is, because people are like, oh, it's a flat tax. It's simpler. It's, you know, easier. But the way of describing it is, this is not a tax cut. This is a change in the way that we're using the power of government to distribute costs and benefits in society. And what this is going to do is redistribute benefits to the top income bracket in the state. And what it's going to mean for the rest of us is, you know, how are we going to fund highway construction? How are we going to fund schools? Mm-hmm. How are we going to do all the things that we need to do? And, you know, maybe you get like 200 additional bucks, you know, if you're at the right part of the income distribution, and like,
that you're probably going to be spending on a sales tax anyways.
Yeah,
that'll exactly just go immediately to the increases
taxes. Property taxes, which continue to go up, right? Somebody pays somewhere.
Exactly. All right. Well, Dr. Phil Rocco, thank you so much for joining us and explaining, breaking this down for us. I told at the break, that Kansas story is really something. And so making a little bit more noise about that, I think, would be good. But we will have you back soon. Thank you so much for your time, sir. And have a great day.
With you, as ever.
All right. Take care. We are going to go to the top of the hour news, and when we come back, thanks again. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Sucker, I ain't one. From now on, I'm keeping my pay. Ain't gonna need up none. So put your 1044 where the sun don't shine. Straighten out your own damn mess. You can write me off, 'cause I ain't giving a dime to the
Thank you for listening to As Goes Wisconsin, available on Spotify, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please subscribe and leave us a rating. As Goes Wisconsin is a product of Civic Media and airs live across Wisconsin Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Civic Media is a statewide network of radio stations broadcasting local news, local sports, thoughtful commentary, and hand-picked music. We are always streaming on the Civic Media app. Find out where you can listen on the air or learn more about Civic Media and sponsorship opportunities by going to our website, civicmedia.us. We thank you for listening.